Welcome to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast with founders Stan Campbell and Mike Darter. If you're forced to fight the battle for your life, CCW Safe will fight the battle for your future.
All right, welcome back to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast. I'm Mike Darter in Oklahoma City. Here with
Stan Campbell, Oklahoma City.
And Don West again. Nice to see you guys.
Awesome group here.
Good New Year.
Great New Year.
Yeah.
Great weather.
Any discussion this morning about resolutions made or kept? Or
you know, I'm not even there yet.
No.
Well, I'm don't just have trying that. To hang on. I feel like I'm, you know, just hanging on by the seat of my pants with everything going on.
I try not to you know, stress myself out with self promises.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I
want to keep a low standard.
I just finally have decided I can't go drinking with you guys anymore.
I think we've decided that too.
That's right.
Well, Happy New Year.
All right, buddy.
So last week we had an awesome discussion with Don on kind of the critical phases of a lethal self-defense incident. And Stan, you made a good comment just a minute ago. You said there's something about, what was it? There's something about knowing.
Yeah. So what I was saying, and this was off air, but I was talking about, you know, just this three-part podcast series that we're in right now, that, you know, if I were, you know, just a customer of CCW Safe, you know, I really would appreciate, you know, what we're doing, in that we're taking the mystery away from the process and kind of letting you, you know, have an understanding of what could happen, and the fact that, you know, I have a team behind me that's not just hiring a lawyer and disappearing or throwing money at the case, mm-hmm. and walking away. That, you know, you actually have a group of experts that are there for you. You know, I call it a dream team, but I love these guys. But you put a dream team together to help you with your defense strategy and managing your case, to make sure the local attorneys are doing what they're supposed to be doing, to make sure the case moves forward, to make sure that you're getting ahead of the case, so they're not just waiting on someone to file charges and make a decision. You're placing boots on the ground, you know, getting investigators, you know, ahead of things, making sure that the local investigators have not missed anything, you know, applying, you know, our own team of homicide detectives to go look at things, our liaisons on the administrative side to work with the family, you know, those who have actually not just read about it, but who have been through what you're going to go through, you know, in a lethal force incident, self-defense incident, to include using deadly force and, you know, going through the process that your family will have to go through, the pressures, and also being sued, which myself and Mike have had to go through. And so it just kind of gives you as a member, and, you know, from my perspective, just thinking about it objectively, you know, a member who receives this type of top-notch service, you know, it makes them feel comfortable and just knowing that, you know, we're going to be there for them and they're part of a family versus just a number.
You know, not just a service too. I mean, the information that we put out is based on the experience of us, of Don, of other people. You know, we have Larry Vickers, we have Dr. Artwall, these people who are experts in the field, in their respective field. And it gives, I think all of that just gives, can give you a, and even for non-members, I mean, somebody listening to this podcast, last week was pretty awesome to hear Don go through all that. We kind of went through from a self-defense incident to bail, because that's the first kind of phase that you're going to have to go through, because all, like you say, all shootings are going to be investigated.
That's right.
It gives you a confidence. It gives you a comfort level, and it gives you a calm, I think, you know, during this turbulent time, if you are forced to defend yourself, you know, and a lot of people, they don't, there's such a, I mean, there's just, there's no easy way to talk about it, right? And people don't, so I think sometimes people don't realize, they just see another shooting that happened. But you have to realize, you know, a lot of these shootings, they're legitimate self-defense incidents.
That's
they
right.
are legitimately being attacked. They're legitimate incidents where somebody is being violated.
Yes.
And people have the right to defend themselves.
Absolutely.
So we talked about, we got kind of up to bail. We kind of ended with that. And before we get into the next phase, which is kind of, I guess, Don, would it be the trial phase of this?
Yeah, I think so. Although in between bail and
pre-trial.
Trial is going to be this. Well, first, it's going to be the charging decision.
Okay.
That's right.
Are charges filed? And if so, what are they? That's followed shortly thereafter legally by an arraignment when you face the formal charges, and then you're off to the races. You have a trial date, and then the somewhat extended pretrial phase, which is when you actively engage in discovery and more intense investigation. And that can be months, and depending on the complexity of the case, and could extend well into a year or two or more. I'm actually consulting on a case now. Here we are in early 2019, where the shooting incident was in August of 2015.
Wow.
So we're 3.5 years in it and still haven't gone to trial.
Wow.
So before we get to that, we ended with bail. Bail, we agreed that there's a good chance if it's a murder, attempted murder, murder 1, 2, or manslaughter, there's a good chance it could be $500,000 or more, which would be a $50,000 bail bondsman fee, which is cash, which is gone. You do not get that money back. That's one of the things that was important for our service to cover. You know, after our first or second year, we extended that bond for just our basic membership up to $500,000 because of that chance of that happening. And we don't want to have a member forced with putting in, or not being able to get out of jail because they're not covered. They're covered to $25,000, and that's, I think, in a lot of the services out there, they top out at that. I mean, a lot of them are $5,000, $10,000, which...
Yeah, if they even get there to start with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a non-member situation for a second, meaning somebody who fully never expects to be involved in one of these, but tragically does. And they may very well have to make that decision. Do they spend their $50,000 that they've saved their whole life to accumulate to get out of jail? Or do they spend that $50,000 to get a start on hiring lawyers and experts and investigators? And there are people that clearly can't afford both.
Yeah, and Mike, there was a doctor that you know of from Oklahoma,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. That was a case. He's now a member of ours, but he had he got found not guilty on a case that, from what I saw, is clear that it was in self-defense, but he still had to go through a trial. He had his case ended up costing $750,000, which, you know, the case of Maddox was $350,000 because we know how to manage that. If you don't have anybody able to manage the cost of that, it can spiral out of control quickly. And I'm sure, Don, you've seen that happen before time and time again.
If I'm not mistaken, the case you're talking about wasn't even a lethal self-defense case, right?
Right.
This shooting.
It was just a shooting. It was a shooting. The guy didn't die. The doctor applied immediately, went to work and applied pressure, you know, called 911, applied medical, services to the guy. And Yeah, he was sued. $750,000 later, he was found not guilty. And that $750,000 came from his retirement, which was his full retirement that he had saved $750,000. And he was 1 year away from retirement.
Well, you could look at that as an outlier, I suppose. We certainly wouldn't want everybody to think if they're ever involved in a self-defense shooting, it's going to cost three-quarters of $1 million. But from my personal experience and private practice and work with this company, if you look at law of self-defense experts that spend their whole life working in this area, guys like Andrew Branca, for example, who mm-hmm. He did a terrific course on basically the cost of defending yourself in a lethal self-defense shooting. And $300,000 to $500,000 is fully to be expected. Mm-hmm. And that's if there's nothing extraordinary about the case or that it's not a politically driven prosecution or something that really ramps it up.
Well, and like you said, even if it's $50,000, you know, if you have $50,000 saved, are you going to use that to get out of jail and then you have nothing? Or are you going to sit in jail for 6 months to a year and use that as a down payment for your attorney and then have to go get a mortgage on your house to continue paying the attorney for that whole time?
Yeah, that's the financial worst case scenario, isn't it? You successfully defend your life against an illegal, violent attacker, mm-hmm. and now you're confronted with facing a zealous prosecutor who, for one reason, not impugning bad faith or anything malicious, but they just see it differently. Mm-hmm. Maybe there isn't enough forensic evidence to make it clear, or maybe there's a witness that has an axe to grind. Pretty soon the case gets prosecuted and there you are in a completely legally justified shooting facing a first degree or a second degree murder charge for which, you know, in the case in point in the doctor, it doesn't matter how much resources you have, whatever you have, you're going to be willing to spend.
Yeah.
Because you're in that terrible, terrible position of facing a significant prison sentence versus having and facing that with a less than effective defense. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you do? Where do you not spend the money when you need it?
And that's what we're going to get into today, because how do you make that decision? You know, that's going to be a tough decision to make. And that's, so let's get right into that. Let's talk about if we've gotten through the bail and you're out of jail and now you have this other phase that is starting where everything's going to start ramping up toward charges and filing. So the attorney, if you've gotten out on bail, you obviously have hired an attorney, most likely, right?
Yes. And let me make a comment more or less as an aside, because I'm certainly not trying to scare anybody or make them feel that they truly have no choice, because the Sixth Amendment, the United States Constitution, and I think virtually every state in the country has some sort of public defender system, or at least they have some sort of indigent counsel program. So one of the great things that we have in this country is a guarantee to counsel for those that can't afford it. There can be abuses, there can be inadequacies, there can be lawyers that are overworked and underpaid, but the system exists as a safety net. So everybody's going to have a lawyer if they're facing a serious charge. Everybody should have access to certain support services to the extent the funding is available. But what you lose by being involved in the public defender system as counsel is you lose all choice. You have no say in who your lawyer is, or typically who the investigators or the experts are. And you have to work within the confines and the budget limits of that system. Some of the best lawyers I know are or have worked in the public defender system, but all of those lawyers have time constraints. They typically have more work than any one human being can handle, and they simply have to prioritize. Mm-hmm. And when you're in that unfortunate situation of defending your life and you didn't commit a crime, that you are one of those people that has been falsely accused, there really can't be any limit on your defense.
Absolutely. You know, that's one of the things that I'm really happy about, just to take a sidestep. You know, when, being aligned with our core values and our experience and being committed to, you know, designing the right model and closely being parallel with the police union model that we were all awarded as police officers. You know, we made some really, really great decisions in the beginning when we established CCW Safe on how our model was going to be run to not have caps on our defense, you know, be it criminal or civil defense. And, you know, to also, you know, not be a reimbursement product, not, you know, pay 100% of the fees associated with trial and pretrial upfront, so that you don't have to, you know, because if we were in a situation where we were a reimbursement product and only gave 20% upfront, you know, that's, you know, falls back on what Michael said, 20% in a case like that, that might be $50,000, mm-hmm. you know, and you have to make a decision, take that $50,000, put it, you know, apply it so that I can get out of jail. And then you have $0 for an attorney. And then you have to figure that out. And then you have to have a not guilty verdict before you get paid back your 80%. So we knew not to be, you know, set up that way. And then also, you know, you have other, you know, programs out there. You know, I mean, we pay the retainer needed for our attorneys, you know, and most, and I know Don can, you know, lean on this, but, you know, a lethal force case, you know, it's six figures easy. You know, $100,000 for a retainer is just the beginning of what a case might cost and what would be assigned or requested by an experienced trial attorney for use of force case like that. And you know, attaching yourself to program attorneys where you only give them $50,000 to work a case, you know, once that money runs out, then it falls back on their firm to pay the rest. So, you know, the incentive to keep pushing forward in the case, they start thinking about their firm's money versus what's the best thing that you can do for your members. And that's why I'm really, really proud of what we've come up with for CCW Safe. But go ahead, Don. I'm gonna get you back into the critical phases.
Well, these stages that we're talking about, sort of the breakpoints where that maybe the goal changes or is redirected. Obviously, if you've been arrested, you don't want to be charged. If you've been charged, you don't want to be convicted. And following a successful bail hearing, being out on bail, you're able to go back to your family and back to work with obvious limitations. But the next thing that's going to happen in the case is the prosecuting authority is going to make a charge decision. Mm-hmm. That means that either through their own authority, depending on what state they're in, they can sign off on a document called an information and formally charge you with a criminal act, or in other jurisdictions, they would present the case to the grand jury. And yes. Then the grand jury would return what's called a true bill or an indictment.
Yes.
And you'd be formally prosecuted, arraigned, and then a court date set. Interestingly, if the case goes before a grand jury, in some jurisdictions, you may have the opportunity to testify as an accused if you're invited to do that, or maybe even offer other evidence. That's not common, but in that moment, if you do have the chance to do that, that is a critical stage in all of this for the decision between you and your lawyer. What do we do at that point? Do we think we can tip the balance and keep from getting charged at the risk of doing something or saying something that may hurt the case later? Mm-hmm. Or are we just blowing smoke in the air that these guys have already decided what they're going to do and that anything we do to help them or to further their investigation will prejudice us down the road. So there's a lot of strategy going on. It doesn't happen very often. Frankly, the prosecutors present their cases. The grand jury does largely mm-hmm. what the prosecutor wants.
Yes.
And then the indictment is returned. There are those cases where you might call them political hot potatoes.
Yes.
There are a few of those where the prosecutor may have the authority himself or herself to actually file the charges, but doesn't want to because they don't want to take the heat for the decision.
Yes.
I know that in Florida, in the Zimmerman case, mm-hmm. the first prosecutor was preparing to present that case to a grand jury. Hmm. And before the grand jury was convened, that was the decision that that prosecutor made in conjunction with the police department, who would be presenting the evidence. Before that happened, the governor appointed a special prosecutor and from another jurisdiction who came in and actually dissolved the grand jury on that case and decided to file charges on her own. So instead of presenting what was at that point maybe the most highly publicized self-defense case in decades,
yes,
she decided not to put it in front of the grand jury, but rather to exercise her authority, and she filed an information for second-degree murder.
Wow.
And we all know how that went. Yeah. A year and a half later, after a jury trial and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars if you add it all up, thousands of hours of effort, the result was what it should have been from the very beginning.
Frankly. Absolutely.
So in any event, there will be a charging decision made. And between the bail and that decision, if there's a way that you can impact or influence that decision by providing information to the prosecutor, perhaps considering a further interview, if you're really confident that may help, pointing them to witnesses or evidence they may not be aware of, perhaps clarifying or offering another interpretation on evidence they think is significant, but you think may actually be favorable. Those kinds of things can happen, and occasionally with a concerted effort, good resources, and quality people, you can have enough of an influence that the prosecutor will rethink the case, maybe look at it from a different perspective, knowing that they shouldn't go forward with the case unless they are convinced of guilt and their ability to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt of that guilt. Sometimes you can have enough of an influence that they'll actually decide not to go forward. Mm-hmm. So you've won the case at that point. You haven't had to go to trial, and the end result is the one you wanted right from the beginning, which is no charges being filed.
What's the percentage of it going, or just by jurisdiction, the percentage of it leaning toward a grand jury versus going to trial?
Well,
is it more likely to go to grand jury?
The cynic in the legal community, which is probably every lawyer that's ever been in the legal community, is a bit cynical because they see things that don't make much sense to them. The cynics say a good prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. So if the prosecutor wants somebody to be indicted, they can probably present the evidence in such a way to convince a grand jury to go ahead and return the indictment. The defense typically does not have the opportunity to be to offer evidence. The accused is not present. No witnesses specifically for the defense would typically be called. So it's a one-sided thing with hearsay.
Yes.
So often the investigating officer can merely take the stand and summarize the evidence.
Now, there's a news in Florida that a law passed last year, which presented a new phase before that, correct? Or in reference to a hearing associated with self-defense.
Yes, I think Florida probably, if not in the forefront of that, certainly is the one that gets the most attention
yes.
by the media around the country. In 2005, Florida passed a statute which they called Stand Your Ground. Mm-hmm. And that has often been misinterpreted or misapplied. What Stand Your Ground means from a self-defense perspective simply is that any duty to retreat from a lethal attack before using deadly force was eliminated.
Gotcha.
So in other words, you didn't have to try to get away before you could respond against a legitimate, bona fide deadly attack. The bill that I'm talking about in Florida, though, was styled Stand Your Ground because it changed that aspect of self-defense law, But what it did is it provided for a system better called self-defense immunity. Mm-hmm. That's a vehicle that's now evolved over the last 10, 12, 13 years. It doesn't look as much like it did originally as it does now, but the bottom line is that if you're claiming self-defense, there is a way that you can file a motion, request before the court, get a hearing before you go to jury trial, mm-hmm. where you present a claim of self-defense. And if the judge agrees that you acted in self-defense, then the judge has the authority to dismiss the case. Mm-hmm. So you never have to go to trial at that point. Now, what has changed over the years, which is pretty significant, is that under the first version of the statute, in order to claim self-defense immunity, you had to present a case to the judge and convince the judge by a preponderance of the evidence, 51%, mm-hmm. that you acted in self-defense. Now the law has changed to become more consistent with the prosecution's burden at a criminal trial. Not completely, but now the defendant files a request for self-defense immunity, mm-hmm. advises the judge they acted in self-defense, and at the hearing is required to put on enough evidence to make a prima facie case. Basically, that if all of that's true, yes, it's self-defense. And then the prosecutor is required to convince the judge by clear and convincing evidence, a little less than beyond a reasonable doubt, but a lot more than a preponderance of the evidence. Mm-hmm. They have to convince the judge by clear and convincing evidence that the accused did not act in self-defense,
yes.
which is largely the standard in trial. So mm-hmm. now, in any reasonably good self-defense claim, you have an opportunity presented to the court. The court can take evidence just like he or she would at a trial and then analyze it, apply the law that relates specifically to those facts, and then enter a decision that could actually wind up dismissing the case. Okay. So anyway, that's what you're referring to as self-defense immunity. It's typically brought after criminal charges are filed. It could also be brought in response to a civil suit where you are sued for wrongful death in a self-defense claim and no criminal charges were filed, but you get sued. But most often it's in a criminal context. What I alluded to earlier, it relates exactly to this, and that is that those standards for self-defense immunity apply at every stage of the investigation. So just like in the Draca case, the sheriff would have looked at that. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, the prosecutor would have looked at that to decide, can they prove the case that it wasn't self-defense and such.
Okay, so in this, in that phase, and we're specifically talking about Florida at this time because they are leading the charge in this type of in that phase, correct? It's not nationwide. It's just a Florida.
It's state by state.
It is state by
so
state.
So there are a number of states now in the U.S. that have some similar statute on self-defense immunity. I know that most of the states that have it still require the defense to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that they acted in self-defense rather than putting the burden on the prosecution. Mm-hmm. In some situations, the accused can actually recover attorney's fees and costs.
Wow.
So it's a bit of a deterrent to civil suits in that respect.
Okay.
So I think there's a real social value there, frankly.
So so in that, and you know, as we move forward, it's really important, especially as, you know, CCW Safe's response, it's important, you know, at that time to get your investigators involved, correct?
Yeah,
so that's kind of where we're moving next,
yeah.
correct? Mm-hmm. And making those decisions.
Well, we hope that there's been an investigator involved to some degree in the case early on, but after a charging decision is made, a couple of things happen. Procedurally, there's an arraignment. The mm-hmm. accused is brought in, enters a plea of not guilty. Typically, a trial date is set, and then you formally enter the discovery phase.
Okay.
That's typically months or years long, depending on the complexity of the case and how much evidence there is to analyze, how many witnesses, such, how significant the legal issues are that might present motions to suppress, that sort of thing. But in any event, you clearly want to have qualified, competent, aggressive investigators out there that are interviewing witnesses, that are retracing the steps that law enforcement took. When you're in the discovery phase, it's probably more accurately called the reciprocal discovery phase, and that is the prosecution, depending on where you are, would be required to give the defense certain kinds of evidence, the statements of the accused, witness statements, typically lab results from forensic evidence and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And then most places have a reciprocal obligation on the defense. So when they have a witness they want to call, when they have physical evidence, even photographs that they want to present, there's usually a requirement that they disclose that prior to trial. Mm-hmm. In a few places, Florida notably, which is interesting, is that Florida allows depositions in criminal cases as part of discovery. Most places don't. In Florida, you can subpoena the lead investigator and any other witness to the case, bring them to a room, put them under oath, and ask them questions just like they were on the stand, and learn in great detail what they know about the case. Some people complain that it's giving away too much from the prosecution side. My experience, having done this for a long time, is that it really helps identify the issues. It narrows the issues. It clearly helps identify the facts that are in dispute. And frankly, it helps avoid a lot of long trials, simply because you now know, for the most part, what happened and who's going to say it. But that being a part, the discovery phase is typically that exchange and then analysis of the information and the evidence the other side has. Okay. So while you may want an investigator out on the street, you also, as a defense lawyer, and certainly as a prosecutor, want the benefit of consulting experts.
Yes.
I imagine when you were working in law enforcement, that part of your job would be to identify physical evidence. It might be the location of blood spatter. It might be drugs in a corner of a room or any number of things that would have resulted in the evidence being collected and then submitted to a lab for analysis.
That's correct.
That's sort of what the crime scene techs do. Mm. The what's the TV show, CSI?
Yeah, CSI.
Right. Well, I think it's a bit misleading to think that's the way it actually works. There are some incredible resources that law enforcement and the defense have to process and analyze physical evidence. So if the prosecutor has an expert, and the most obvious expert they would have in a homicide case would be a forensic pathologist, otherwise known as a coroner or a medical examiner.
Yes.
A doctor who does the autopsy typically forms an opinion about cause of death, manner of death, and would often testify and say, in my opinion, this is how this person died. It's common and expected, I think, that the defense, if there is any issue about that, would also want the benefit of a consulting medical examiner, forensic pathologist type expert. Now, when I say consulting, I mean someone whose job would be to review the evidence with counsel and then help them understand the evidence, perhaps help them frame questions to the opposing party's experts.
Now, in a self-defense case, is this, and this is for the audience, for you to answer, Don, not only the cause of death and, you know, taking in all the evidence, you know, this particular witness also can help with, identifying, you know, the distance, you know, between the shooter and the deceased as well, and other, you know, things associated with you know, that can help your cases, in that sense, correct?
Without question, that becomes a critical part of the forensic evidence analysis. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Keeping in mind from the very beginning, we've said what people say happened becomes the starting point.
That's right.
And if you say, this is what happened, this is where I was, this is where the guy I shot was when it happened, you have then staked it out. Mm-hmm. And then typically law enforcement will try to prove or even disprove what you've said. That becomes the basis for investigation. Well, if they take that and the medical examiner says, from my internal examination of the bullet path, that's nonsense. It could not have happened that way.
Yes.
Now you've got a problem. Now you've got a lot of explaining to do. If you've just told the police it happened this way, and the medical examiner is going to say that was an impossibility. There could be a question about what the cause of death was. How did they die, and what were there several shots, only one of which was fatal, and multiple participants? I mean, you can make it into a million different scenarios, but more specifically to your question, a medical examiner or other forensic expert would also examine clothing.
That's right.
For the presence of what they would call defects or holes. They would look for the presence of gunshot residue. They may submit that clothing for further analysis to a state law enforcement agency or even the FBI, who would look for gunshot residue, blood, those sorts of things that would help answer some of those questions about the relative position of the individuals. The muzzle distance is incredibly important.
Yes.
You know, we're looking at, was the threat imminent? And if the shot was fired within a couple of feet from the attacker, that says a lot about the proximity of these two guys, as opposed to it being clear from that evidence or other evidence that they would have had to have been a lot farther apart. So all of that fits together in telling the story that corroborates or refutes witness statements.
Yes. And how about, you know, the testing of blood, for instance? I mean, does that help hurt the case? Is that something that you would be looking for to happen on, you know, of the deceased and or the person that you're defending?
Well, blood analysis could mean lots of different things. Blood analysis could be if you have a jacket that has blood on it, and you have two guys that were involved in a fight that led to a fatal encounter, and the jacket has the blood of both people. That tells a lot of how close these guys were to each other. If it only has the blood of one person and the other person was bleeding, but also claims this person was on top of him attacking him,
yes,
the prosecution would love to have the absence of evidence to make an argument.
That's
there.
True.
When you're also talking about blood, you may be looking at splatter, a blood trail that helps identify where people went after they were involved in this this incident. But I think probably what you were getting at was analyzing the blood for intoxicants of some sort.
Yes, sir.
You analyze the blood to see who's been drinking, who's been smoking dope, who's on some mind-altering substance that would have affected their judgment.
That's right.
So, absolutely.
And then sometimes it goes along with witness statements as well. You know, if you had somebody that was on PCP, for instance, and or anything like that.
You know, that's an interesting comment because thinking back to the George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin case, it's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback on the police conduct in that case. They were criticized by some for not arresting him that night. And that's maybe what started some of the uproar that eventually happened in the case. I think they had good reason, based upon probably what we'll talk about another day, not to make the arrest. But there is some second guessing that probably would have helped the case. And that is that George Zimmerman wasn't asked for blood or breath at the scene.
Yes.
So therefore, it was easy to claim, well, we don't know what was in his blood. We don't know what may have affected his judgment and such. And law enforcement spent a lot of time with him, and they had no reason to think he was impaired. So they didn't ask him for anything. Now, projecting that down the road to a situation where one of our members could find themselves in a self-defense scenario, we typically talk about limiting interaction with law enforcement until you've had the benefit of counsel.
Correct.
And such. There's one thing, though, that while I would never agree to a search, simply because I don't think you want to consent to something that you then have no control over.
Yes.
certainly not without the benefit of counsel, or requiring law enforcement to do what they're trained and paid to do. They prepare a warrant and have a judge authorize it. So we'll talk about that another day too, I hope. But if you're at the scene and you've been involved in a self-defense shooting and you know that you have no intoxicants in your system, you haven't been drinking, there's no drugs in your system, and you think there may be some question about that.
Yes.
I don't see any problem with saying, I would like to offer a sample of blood.
Gotcha.
I would like to take a breath test because I want you guys to know that I'm not impaired, that I'm thinking clearly.
Yes.
And that my actions were based upon me being attacked.
Awesome. And you know, and moving into that and talking about experts, what about the decision sometimes? I know we've done this in some of our cases, the decision to either have a on standby or actually use a use of force expert and their testimony.
Well, you know, Stan, that this discovery phase that we've been talking about is usually pretty extended. And there will be a point in time where the defense receives all they're going to get from the prosecutor, in terms of witness statements and evidence and such. And then coupled with the explanation that may have been given by the accused, you then have a pretty complete view of what happened. A use of force expert can be critically important in assessing what actually happened, but I think ultimately in communicating it to a jury. Someone that can get up there and talk about their training and experience, and to the extent that the judge allows them, talk about human reaction and thinking and psychological stresses, talk about physical ability and capacity. You know, for example, in a self-defense incident, it's really the relative abilities of the individuals that helps define whether it was self-defense. You know, an unarmed person who's skilled or big and strong certainly can be a deadly threat to someone with a gun. And some of the most sensational self-defense cases you can think of that were legitimately self-defense is when an individual with a gun winds up having to use it against what's characterized as an unarmed person, but nonetheless someone who, through their strength and training and ability and just rage, for example, can clearly injure or kill somebody.
That's right. And then just before we move away from experts, you know, circling back around, it's really important on the defense side, you know, to have, you know, an expert that can come in and possibly turn the case around, like it happened in the Maddox case, for instance, in which you have an expert in place to dispute evidence presented by the state side, correct?
That's a really good point to illustrate, because in that case, the lawyers hired, with our assistance, a preeminent forensic pathologist who reviewed the work done by the state medical examiner and discovered a couple of things. One, the conclusion that she was wrong about certain findings that she made regarding entry and exit wounds during the autopsy, that she got the direction and trajectory wrong. On this was a total of 5 shots in this case. But perhaps most importantly, and had the biggest significance, I think, on the case ultimately, was that the medical examiner failed to identify other physical evidence that was really important in helping relate the relationship of the two individuals, Stephen Maddox and the his attacker, as to their physical proximity, where they were when the shots were fired. Stephen had said that by the time he was able to discharge his weapon, he had to continue to discharge it because his attacker continued to charge him and actually got on top of him and drove him to the ground. So he thought the last couple of shots, they were actually belly to belly on the ground.
Yes.
That's a pretty pretty remarkable thing in the self-defense world, that your attacker, having been shot, continues to attack, continues to charge, not incapacitated by one or two or three shots, and actually is able to get his hands on you and drive you to the ground.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty funny, and I know Dr. Artwall and the Forest Science Institute, you know, that they presented a video a couple of years back about, you know, Hollywood and what we as, well, not as policemen, but we as a community of those who accept movies and television as what actually happens. You know, you talked about CSI a little while ago. You know, I'm a CSI, Law and Order, you know, fan, and as are most people. And, you know, they think that, you know, just because they get all these things done in 30 minutes, this is actually how it goes. And, you know, you have to think about even, you know, a motivated assailant, a person, an attacker, although they're being, you know, you shoot them several times, depending on placement of the shots or their motivation along with, and you add in an intoxication level or mental health issues, the person can still continue through being shot several times. And just like in the Maddox case, end up on top of you and force you to do something like that.
And not only be able to continue physically, but have a significant amount of their strength that will continue to the point where they ultimately lose enough blood to lose consciousness.
Yes.
So not only are they still awake and aware and able to fight, but can continue to do so for some period of time. I know, 10, 15, 20 seconds, maybe.
Yes.
You've all heard stories about, I've all heard stories about people being shot in the heart and still being able to unload their handgun or reload and shoot some more until they basically, in a sense, bleed out.
Absolutely. That's some amazing stuff.
So just to put the dot on the I there, the expert that we hired in that case was able to find physical evidence that proved that these guys were on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
That completely undermined the prosecution theory that that Steven shot this guy from far away, that he had no reason to shoot him. He wasn't an imminent threat because he was some distance away. So once that evidence came in, I think it was clear the jury was with us.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I'm going to try to find that video of Artwall to include in the show notes. Yeah. And that's one thing that I, you know, the time I was with ATF was dealing with ballistics. So there's a lot of ballistics evidence that is going to come forward, whether it's through distance determination, stippling, the cylinder gap, all that. And then also, you know, the just determining which rounds were fired from what gun and so forth.
Yeah. And then, you know, piggybacking a thought from that Don had a few minutes ago, you know, talking about the prosecutors, their case, you know, a lot of times, and here at CCW Safe, I said, you know, most of us are law enforcement officers and we don't police bash, but, you know, a lot of times the agenda or the prosecutor's case is influenced by the officers on the scene, the first, you know, responding officers or the investigators. And, you know, sometimes, like in the Maddox case, you know, they felt that it was a murder case and that's what they presented. You know, even so, you know, our relationships with medical examiners, for instance, you know, one of the things that can make a medical examiner go, you know, shoot off in a different direction is what the officers present in the beginning. You know, and I remember after, you know, Maddox, you know, got his not guilty verdict and he was here in Oklahoma City visiting with us, you know, he talked about how, you know, something that I didn't know at the time because it didn't come up, but how when, you know, he was there with the investigators that they were testing his right hand for, you know, gunpowder. And he let them know that it was, you know, his left hand that you know, he's left-handed. That's what he shot with. And they said, don't worry about it. And, you know, because they had already had in their minds that he admitted to pulling the trigger and, you know, it doesn't even matter. And their agenda was to push forward that case. And just thinking about that, you know, you know, we have to say that, you know, officers are, you know, human, that they're human errors, you know, at times that can affect the case and send it somewhere where it should not be and launch it out of the realm of or the, you know, the narrative of a self-defense case as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that as human beings, we have to be aware of this idea, and especially if we're involved in investigating something and trying to remain objective with an open mind, it's that You know, that notion of confirmation bias, the idea that you have an idea, you have a belief of what has happened. And then as new information comes, you have a tendency only to give credit to the stuff that confirms what you thought happened and either minimize or ignore stuff that's inconsistent with that.
Yes.
Well, that's deadly for a police officer.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they really have to struggle, I would think. And that's why roundtabling stuff and having fresh eyes on it that says, you know, have I missed something here? Am I seeing something different? And I suspect that's what you're saying, Stan, is that, again, the Monday morning look back mm-hmm. on the way that investigation took place in Stephen's case was that they got an idea too early about what they thought happened and then attempted after that to confirm that or to bolster that rather than regrouping when the defense developed information that was inconsistent, even when they themselves realized some of their earlier conclusions may not have been right about the videotape and
absolutely.
Stuff we've talked about other times.
And that's the importance of, you know, like you and Gary and some of the other investigators work here for CCW Safe to work along with the local attorneys and you bring in all the discovery and review the case and you have a strategy meeting and you guys kind of go over all the evidence and the reports and the witness statements and everything that you have prior to going to trial. You know, it's important to do that, you know, along with, or talk about that for a second and then jump into, you know, the next phase of that is when we start talking about bringing in consultants for jury.
Well, you know, it doesn't really matter what you've done until you can actually put it in the courtroom, because the only truth for the jury is what they see and hear that comes out of that witness stand or is part of the evidence exhibits and stuff. Mm-hmm. But even before the jury gets there, you realize that how everyone that comes into the courtroom has had a prior life, that their views of things, the filters through which they see things and interpret things, has a lot to do with their own prior experiences, their own attitudes and values. And as a criminal defense trial lawyer, frankly, as a prosecutor, the last thing you should think you can do is change somebody's core values or make them change their mind about something. You may be able to educate them, and if they have an open mind and aren't otherwise firmly attached to something, you can have an influence. But to believe that you're going to take someone and convert them to your view is silly.
Yes.
So we really want to know who the people are that may be sitting on the jury.
That's right.
We want to know what their background is, and they'll tell us. That's voir dire. That's the jury selection process. You can ask them questions, and depending on who the judge is, you may get lots of time or maybe not, just a few minutes. So often, lawyers on both sides will retain a jury expert. In the biggest cases, those experts will sometimes do surveys. They sometimes will do mock presentations and such. But at a minimum, you would want a jury consultant present to watch the jury selection, get their own impressions of the individuals, see how they align with the big issues in the case. But even more importantly these days is that you can find out so much more and so easily by doing a juror background investigation by nothing more complicated than looking at their social media presence, mm-hmm. looking at how they present and are they consistent with what they're saying now with what they said 2 weeks ago online. So the more information, the better. The ability to gather it quickly and process it quickly and get it to the lawyers so they can allow it to percolate and affect the decisions, I think now in this day and age is critical. And any well-respected courtroom lawyer, I think, is going to use that resource now.
Mm-hmm. That brings up a good point, too, social media, that we always stress for our members. And if you are involved in a in a self-defense shooting, to not get caught up in posting things on social media. You know, we're talking, I think it was the last podcast last week, we were talking about some of the things that, Don, you asked, some of the things that we've seen where people get in trouble, get themselves in trouble. And that's another area where people commonly get themselves in trouble is through the media or social media, either one. Because if you're in a shooting, you're probably going to be contacted by media, news, you know, stories. And you want to definitely let, you know, your attorney handle that. And if you're a CCW Safe member, we manage that for you. So, that's all great points. It's another great podcast. And now I'm thinking, man, it'd be great to get on one. I believe Sean had a write up not too long ago talking about things to do, if you are in a lethal self-defense battle regarding your social media. That might be a great podcast to get Sean on for that. So, well, Don, man, it's great to have you back in Oklahoma City. It's always good to have you here. We're looking forward to this kind of reshooting this, the next fight series, which went through kind of just the terminology, what to be expected. Here's what this means. Here's what this means. Because there's still a lot more that we didn't talk about when it comes to that. The terminology of the criminal justice system was basically what you had talked about. And I think that's going to be some good information in 2019 as well. Getting some podcasts done on that, getting those videos re-released. I think, like I said, I think we had 26 of them. Stan, great to have you in town.
Thanks, Mike.
We're going to have a busy year. We got a lot of stuff coming up. A lot of content this year.
Yes, sir.
We're going to have. So you guys be safe, and you listeners be safe, and look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thanks, Mike.